This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for conversation with an acclaimed concert pianist, a trip down memory lane in Audubon Park, or a glimpse at the new exhibit, Photography at NOMA. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Internationally acclaimed concert pianist Awadajan Pratt is in New Orleans for a salon recital. The featured performer at Nocturne 11, a black tie gala of MASNO, the Musical Arts Society of New Orleans. Pratt will perform in an intimate setting at the Ritz-Carlton on Sunday. He joins us now by phone. Awadajan, welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you very much.
And welcome to parenthood. Congratulations on your new baby boy.
Thank you very much.
Well, we have lots of firsts to talk about. In addition to the birth of your first child, you are the first African-American pianist to win the Naumburg International Piano Competition back in 1992. Did that event launch your career?
Yes, it did. Before that, I was a student trying to figure out what the next step was, essentially. And then after Naumburg, I turned around and had first 30, then 40, then God knows how many concerts a year. Yeah, that absolutely changed my career.
And you were no ordinary student. As a student at the Peabody Conservatory of Music in Baltimore, you were the first student in the history of the institution to earn simultaneous diplomas in piano, violin, and conducting. To what do you attribute your success?
You know, I think it's just probably loving music and working hard. The first thing drove the second thing, and not quitting.
How did the piano ultimately win as your instrument of choice?
Essentially, it's the issue of repertoire. On the piano, you're dealing with only great composers, and that was my primary motivation.
Were you born into a musical family?
In some respects, I wasn't born into a family of music professionals. My father had studied the organ when he was younger, and had carried that passion for music through his life. So in our house, we listened to classical music all the time.
And it's taken you all around the world, including a recent performance at the White House.
Yeah, I've been absolutely around the world. You know, incredible that I've been able to have these experiences, in addition to playing at the White House 3 times.
So you've played for 2 presidents?
Yeah, I played for President Clinton 2 times. And President Obama once.
And what can we look forward to in New Orleans in your upcoming performance?
New Orleans, I'll have an interesting program that I think, New Orleans would enjoy short pieces, a series of short pieces. There's a Schubert impromptu, there's some works of Couperin, Scarlatti, there's a Chopin Nocturne, and one of the important traditions that's been lost in classical music is the art of improvisation. And it used to be that if you couldn't improvise, you were not considered a musician at all. And so we have, in our history, people like Bach was the greatest improviser of his day, Mozart, Beethoven, again, the greatest improviser of his day, Mendelssohn. Of Chopin, it's said that his compositions are like but a shadow of the genius of his improvisations, and that really tells us something. So that art has been lost, and I've been trying to reclaim it a bit in recent years. So I think that, you know, with New Orleans and its rich history as a jazz loving town, should appreciate that in this concert.
Wow. You are also known for your unconventional appearance when performing. Tell me, what makes you stand out and why do you do it?
Well, I think I would say mercifully or gratefully, now I think I stand out less. I think there's been a much more of a concerted effort over the years for various organizations to realize that the attire that's expected of concert musicians has been a little bit dated, to say the least. And so I think there are a lot of artists who no longer wear tuxes. For me, you know, at the very beginning, it was just kind of like, I don't want to have a jacket on, and I want to look nice and interesting and not boring. So that's how I started things in 1992, I guess.
You won't be in black tie.
I will not be in black tie. That is correct.
Well, in addition to your performance in New Orleans, what else are you looking forward to doing while you're in town?
My wife and child are coming, so we're going to eat a lot. What could be better? Music and food.
Well, I wish you, Jill, and your baby boy all the best. Enjoy New Orleans.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the time.
Acclaimed concert pianist Awadajan Pratt is currently an associate professor of piano and artist in residence at the College Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati. Pratt will perform at the Musical Arts Society of New Orleans Nocturne 11, a gala event benefiting Masno's New Orleans International Piano Competition and the New Orleans Piano Institute. The salon recital takes place at the Ritz-Carlton Sunday, 5 p.m. More info at Masno, masno.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack.
I went on down to the Audubon Zoo, and they all asked for you. They all asked for you.
For who?
Well, they even inquired about you. I went on down to the Audubon Zoo, and they all asked for you. The monkey's ass, the tiger's ass, and the elephant asked me to.
A popular uptown green space is the focus of a new documentary to air on WYES-TV tomorrow night. Audubon Park Memories, produced and narrated by Peggy Scott Laborde, is sure to bring back memories as the park has undergone many changes over time. From sugar plantation to home of one of the country's top zoos. And here to talk about it all is WYES producer Peggy Scott Laborde. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you so much, Diane. Yep, we're talking lions and tigers and bears and memories of different generations. Because not only, of course, we go back to the very, very early days when, as you said, it was, you know, sort of a remnant of a sugar plantation. And then an amazing, even though not financially successful, where have we heard that before? An 1884 World's Fair. Okay. We have some amazing visuals on that. It's as if you were there at the fair. But talking about, you know, for all of us, the more recent past, if you will, the baby boomer past, and then even more recent than that. There are many folks, I hope, who remember the swan boat and the elephant zoo key that you would plug into these little boxes in front of the animal cages, which would convey a message about the history of the zebra, that kind of thing. And some people out there probably still have their zoo keys. But also, we wanted to talk about a newer generation, of course, the new zoo. Surrey, the white Bengal tiger that many people remember, also the white alligator. Alligators, I should say now. There's more than one. You know, when you think about Audubon Park memories, you want to think about many, many generations of that, too.
Who are some of the local folks that share memories with you?
Deacon John Moore, who is one of my favorite persons for so many reasons, one of my go-to persons, because in addition to being New Orleans music legend, he is quite the raconteur. And so to talk about, you know, the more recent past, I tend to knock on his door a lot. And Ron Foreman, of course, and the story would not be complete without all the incredible efforts of Ron Foreman in the past almost now 40 years, and the amazing civic activists and others that have come together working with him at the helm to make the zoo a better place. It's funny, when we were growing up in the 60s, 60s, 50s and 60s, you know, we thought the zoo was just great. But we found out, as it did most zoos and folks around the country, realized that the zoo could be a much better place. And it certainly is. And with the adequate funding and push from the community and the city itself, Mayor Moon Landry was very much a part of helping to get a bond issue. They needed money. It used to be free to go to the zoo, but free then does not translate into building bigger and better things.
WWNO's Gwen Tompkins is among the many who shared stories.
Yes, she has quite a few stories, including one, and I'm just going to, you know, leave it as a tease. First time with a first grade class to the zoo, with seeing some elephants do some unusual things.
Do you have a favorite memory of your own of Audubon Park?
I have this vague memory of hippos who never seemed to want to get out of the water, so that in my visits, I would only see sort of half of them and never knew what the bottom of their body looked like until much later.
Yeah. Mine was the seals.
The seals. Oh, yes. Well, you know, that the colonnade, the seal pool, the sea lion pool, seals, actually was pretty important for a number of reasons. Well, of course, just to go and see it. And it really is one of the symbols of the zoo. But as folks will learn if they don't already know, because the zoo was open and was free, that was a place where people would go and, dare I say, make out.
Oh, my.
At night.
What does it take to put a documentary like this together? How long was it in the making?
It was about 9 months. And let me tell you, it is certainly no one-man show. You know, it's a team. We looked at the events on the calendar, like the Zoo to Do, the Kitty Zoo to Do, the Boo at the Zoo, the Swamp Fest, and we sort of plotted out. Now, we really ought to go to see, in addition to the, you know, the beauty of the park and the zoo and the excitement of the zoo, maybe focus on a few key events through the year and use those as a departure point for our information. So our exterior, if you will, photographer, Lenny Delbert, we were at the zoo and the park a lot throughout the year. So I'd say 9 to 10 months, which actually, to do a one-hour documentary is actually not a very long time. Also, Paul Campbell, who shot our interviews. We interview a lot of people. We interviewed about 20 people. And then I've been sort of living in the edit booth, because that's, of course, the final process of it, in between the pre-production and the writing and gathering of images, with my colleague Larry Russery. Plus, in terms of research, a dear friend, Doris Ann Gorman, and I kind of really get into the research. And then, as you well know, Diane, the research facilities we have here and the availability of information and images. The New Orleans Public Library, Nyrene Wainwright, the Louisiana Archives, the Historic New Orleans Collection, Louisiana State Museum, just Tulane and Loyola. You know, we're very, very blessed to live in a city that's very old, but fortunately values its history, too.
I understand that your interest in telling New Orleans' story and preserving its history goes back a ways with you.
It does. I am a proud graduate of Cabrini High School, and I was involved with extracurricular activities, including the school newspaper. And so I had a column about what to do and see in New Orleans, and I feel very blessed that I'm able to kind of do that from a video standpoint these days, and really proud of it. You know, the other thing about video, a lot of our viewers, when we talk about working on projects, we say, do you have any pictures out there? And the home movies, and having folks share those movies with us, we've got amazing footage and some very rare photos, too.
Now, as you preserve the history of Audubon Park for generations to come, what are your thoughts about its future?
Oh, my goodness. Well, under the leadership of Ron Foreman, and of course, Ron has a great staff. They've expanded beyond those uptown boundaries with the aquarium and the insectarium. You know, there's always something else going on, and what's the next step? And you have to keep moving. And it's also been very gratifying to see something like the Zoo to Do, which raises over $1 million every year. And folks from other zoos around the country come and take lessons as to how to do a fundraiser like that, which is extremely flattering. And the Zoo to Do, it's, you know, over 30 years old. And when you think about some of those amazing heroes like Kitty Duncan and Betty Wisdom and George Montgomery, the list is pretty long. But it's these key people who really worked with Ron to say, let's make this a better place.
Peggy, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you very much, Diane.
Audubon Park Memories, a documentary produced and narrated by Peggy Scott Laborde, airs tomorrow night on WYES-TV, Channel 12, at 7 and 9 p.m. The New Orleans Museum of Art is offering a glimpse at a fraction of its collection of photographs. Of the 10,000 pictures, 132 are on display. Eileen Fleming spoke with curator Russell Long about the exhibition, how NOMA built such an extensive collection starting in the 1970s, and why.
The museum made then the very prescient decision to begin collecting photography in a very serious way. And that was a time when not many other museums were looking at photography, and they weren't collecting it, they weren't building permanent collections. So as a result, the museum actually had very little competition for great things. And of course, the other major factor is that photographs were remarkably inexpensive back then. You know, when you think about a museum like New Orleans Museum of Art, at the time they realized that they might not be able to compete with the Art Institute of Chicago or the Metropolitan Museum of Art in terms of building a collection of Impressionist paintings. But they realized that they could compete with any institution for photography. And as a result of that decision, we now have one of the finest collections of photography, of art photography, in the United States.
And tell me, what makes a good photograph?
As far as what makes a great photograph, it's a difficult question. When I was making the selection for this particular exhibition, I sort of based it on a few different criteria. The first was the image. I wanted it to be a very compelling image. I wanted it to be an image that posed questions to the viewer. I wanted you to look at all of these things and say, well, what's happening here? The second criteria was the condition and the quality of the object itself. Photography is, as you know, a medium of multiples, so there are more than one of most of these things. But if other museums have another example of one of the pictures that you see here on the wall, it's probably not as good as ours. The things that you see in this exhibition are the finest examples of whatever they are. The third criteria was each picture's role in a history of photography. I very much wanted this exhibition to kind of mirror what I call the cultural ambitions of photography. And that is to say that photography has been a part of every aspect of modern life, from science photographs to forensic photography to ethnographic studies to fashion images to advertising images. And each one of those facets are well represented in this exhibition.
Is there a New Orleans section?
The history of photography is full of examples of famous photographers coming to New Orleans. So New Orleans has, in a way, played a very central role in the history of photography. And that made it very easy for me to include New Orleans in a prominent way in this exhibition, in the form of photographs by photographers that most people will know. But some will be surprised to find out that they were here and that they photographed in this city. We're now looking at one of the earliest photographs of New Orleans, a street scene by Theodor Lilienthal, who was a German immigrant, but became a photographer, a commercial photographer, and in the mid-19th century, he was commissioned by the city of New Orleans. It was actually the first municipal photography commission in the United States to make a survey of New Orleans. You're looking at the Charles Hotel, so this is on St. Charles Avenue, just a couple of blocks off of Canal. The building is no longer there. Surrounding the hotel, you see all of these wonderful buildings that we know as New Orleans architecture, the wrought iron balconies. But one of my favorite details is the sign advertising John Lazarus's Great Southern Watch Depot. There's a large oversized pocket watch hanging down from the sign, and because of the great detail in this large glass negative, we know, reading the clock, that the picture was made roughly at 10:02 in the morning. So it's a wonderful kind of serendipitous detail, but a really beautiful slice of life in New Orleans in the middle of the 19th century.
And this one, it looks like it's on glass.
This is one of the photographic negatives that we have on display. It's a glass negative by the well-known New Orleans photographer E.J. Belloc. He also made an entire series of pictures of the Storyville prostitutes. This one shows a mantle. It's believed to be Belloc's own mantle. In it we see pictures of women in bathing suits in sort of posing somewhat coyly, but they're far more chaste than the pictures of the Storyville prostitutes. So it seems to be a sort of strange in-between image, and we don't know of any vintage prints that were made from this negative, so we've decided to show the negative itself. And it is here beautifully displayed with a backlight so that you can really see the image in the negative.
They're all black and white, except I see a red there.
That's right. There are three color images. I should say that the date range of the exhibition runs from 1843 to 1985. We made the decision to not include more contemporary things. We hope to continue building our more contemporary collection, and I wanted to leave room for the possibility of a Photography at NOMA Part 2, 5 to 10 years from now, once we've had a chance to build that collection.
Photography at NOMA, Part 1, runs through January 19th. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. Multi-Grammy-winning trumpeter and composer Randy Brecker plays New Orleans this week with a pair of shows tonight at Snug Harbor, backed by an all-star New Orleans band featuring drummer Johnny Vodakovich and pianist Larry Seberth, and a set at UNO's Sandbar tomorrow night. The New Orleans Fringe Festival is off the leash again, kicking off its sixth annual festival featuring more than 70 performing groups presenting fresh, original theater of all types, running Wednesday through Sunday in the Marigny, Bywater, and Central City neighborhoods. You can visit nofringe.org for the entire lineup and schedule. And it's all about the food come Sunday, as the Oak Street Po' Boy Festival gets underway from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Oak Street between Carrollton Avenue and Leake Avenue. Admission is free. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.